Okay, I think we can get started. This is our second argument of the day. The case is Michael John Houston, appellant, versus Paul Schnell, Minnesota Commissioner of Corrections, respondent. And I just have a few remarks for the attorneys before we begin with the argument. The argument today is being recorded, and the audio from our argument will be available shortly on the court's website. We are keeping time for you today. As you both know, appellant has 15 minutes, respondent has 15 minutes, and then appellant has the opportunity for a five-minute rebuttal. You can see the time being displayed right on our screen. This is a Zoom argument, and occasionally there are Zoom glitches that occur. Even on my end, occasionally, I will freeze. If we experience any issues with the Zoom, we'll pause the argument and continue it when we're all together again in real time. I would ask both attorneys to, and any observers, to remain on mute unless you're the person who is arguing, just to make our audio quality as good as possible. And then finally, I would just ask you both to please identify yourselves before you begin your arguments. And that concludes my remarks. We will begin with the appellant's argument. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bradford Colbert, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Michael John Houston. This appeal concerns two issues relating to Mr. Houston's incarceration and his term of imprisonment. The first issue is whether the commissioner violated the prohibition against ex post facto actions by miscalculating his term of imprisonment. And the second issue is whether the commissioner violated Mr. Houston's right to equal protection by revoking his acceptance for conditional release. I'll address the ex post facto issue first. This issue arises because of the unusual circumstances of Mr. Houston's conviction. Mr. Houston was convicted of second-degree murder. The offense occurred in 1975, but Mr. Houston was not convicted until 2012. The offense occurred in 1975, he received an indeterminate sentence of 20 years. Mr. Houston contended in this lawsuit that the calculation of his release date violated the ex post facto provisions of the Minnesota and the United States constitutions. The district court found that his ex post facto claim was barred by the doctrine of collateral estoppel because Mr. Houston had previously raised a similar issue in a habeas corpus action. The district court was correct in that Houston litigated a similar issue and that collateral estoppel could apply, but the district court did not address Mr. Houston's principal argument that collateral estoppel should not apply because the issue was wrongly decided. Collateral estoppel is an equitable doctrine.
Mr. Colbert.
Oh, go ahead, Judge Riley.
So the Minnesota Supreme Court denied your PFR in that case, right?
That's correct. It wasn't my case at the time, Your Honor, just to be clear. He was proceeding pro se, which is an important factor, a part of this.
So your client's case.
That's correct.
Thank you for the clarification. I'm just wondering if you have any case law that supports your proposition that if you think a case was wrongly decided and the appeals are over, that you can bring it up again, that it's not collaterally estopped.
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes to the language that whenever all the cases talk about collateral estoppel being an equitable, right? It is not something that's to be rigidly applied. And I suggest to you that it kind of you can talk about in the context of post-conviction. There are firm limits as to when you can bring in post-conviction cases, but the courts have been really clear that you can bring a post-conviction case, despite the statute of limitations issue, where there's claims of newly discovered evidence, actual evidence. And so I would suggest in this case, and what Mr. Houston now has a lawyer, and there are issues, and I think the underlying, it's so important that the issue, you know, be that his sentence be correct. And I think if you look through the opinion from this court, there's this discussion about, well, they have complete discretion. And frankly, that's just not true. And I will address what I would suggest to you is explicit and specific evidence that the commissioner violated the ex post facto provision.
Before you do that, I just wanted to just address a related procedural concern, quasi-procedural. So it seems like you're suggesting that because your client was not represented, at least you're implying, not represented, the argument that was presented wasn't as robust as it would have been had he been represented by someone of your esteemed caliber.
Exactly right, John.
But we've got plenty of Minnesota case law that says, you know, if you go it alone, I mean, it's your choice in Minnesota that you're going to be treated. The rules are going to apply to you exactly the same as anyone else.
I that's correct, Your Honor. But I do think it's a factor to be considered into whether to apply the equitable doctrine of collateral estoppel. I think that it doesn't preclude, but I think it's something. And again, if I was simply relitigating the same issue, I don't think an application would be appropriate. But in this case, and again, I do want to address this issue, which the commissioner has admitted doing, right? This is not something we're making up. The commissioner has admitted, backing up. The first really important piece of this is this issue is anchored in the fact that people who were convicted of second-degree murder in 1975 received much shorter sentences than they do now. That is an indisputable fact. There is no question about that. And that was not addressed by this court. There is no question. And in my brief, I offer a fairly lengthy explanation as to why that is. But I just want to make sure that this court recognizes that at the time of his conviction, there was an indeterminate sentence, and at the Commissioner of Corrections used what's called the parole matrix. And at that time, a conviction of second-degree murder with a zero criminal history score, and we can talk about what his criminal history score was, resulted in a sentence of a term of imprisonment. His sentence was 20 years, but a term of imprisonment of 86 months. And so the current...
Mr. Colbert, while we still have time, I am wondering if I could just shift you to a discussion of what I guess I consider to be the elephant in the room, and that is the vehicle that you have used in this case to pursue relief, the Section 1983 action. And I'd like to talk about the district court's conclusion that that was not the appropriate vehicle under United States Supreme Court case law. And specifically, I am wondering if there is anything that prevented you from bringing the two claims here, the one that is arguably subject to collateral estoppel and the other claim involving medical leave, using the procedural vehicle of habeas.
It's a great question, Your Honor, and there's a couple of reasons, one of which is this particular issue can only be resolved with discovery. This is not something that there is evidence. You don't have the trial transcript from the criminal proceeding. You don't have all this evidence. This can only be discovered, and quite frankly, evidence that is in the hands of the Commissioner of Corrections. This is particularly well-suited to a civil case. The habeas case is the rules regarding the discovery of a habeas case are, frankly, up in the air. And it's also complicated in the Minnesota as to whether, you know, it's a habeas, it wouldn't be a post-conviction, which I think goes to the court's question in that habeas, you know, the idea of habeas in the traditional federal sense of the word is a post-conviction. And in Minnesota, that's just not true. We would actually bring a habeas action, which is, in all essence, a civil action. So given that, there is no real, in Minnesota, distinction between a habeas and a civil rights action. And it doesn't make any sense, and I'll address this later, as to why this would be a habeas as opposed to a 1983 action. But specifically, is because we needed discovery. We needed to know exactly what the commissioner did in calculating the sentence. We needed to depose the person who determined his sentence. We needed to look at all that, and that's evidence that's not available in habeas.
And I guess I'm also, you know, in looking at the Wilkinson case that was discussed, I'm particularly interested in what the Supreme Court's rationale for barring Section 1983 actions in federal Section 1983 actions when an individual is challenging the duration of their state sentence. And it looks like the issues are comedy, as I think you mentioned in your brief, but there were also additional considerations provided by the Supreme Court in that case, linguistic specificity and history. And I'm wondering whether those considerations apply when you have a state 1983.
Your Honor, so what the court is clearly about, it's about federal jurisdiction. It's also about the language of the federal habeas statute. And what happens here is the federal habeas statute specifically requires an exhaustion of state remedies, and which fits in the idea of federalism and the idea that the federal court, this is a way of preventing people from going into federal court. I think it's really important to note that no other person other than an incarcerated person has to exhaust state remedies. The Supreme Court has been clear that that's not a precursor. So one has to ask, why incarcerated persons? And the reason is federalism and the federal habeas statute. Those are the only rationale, is those two reasons. And so the federal habeas statute says you have to exhaust state remedies. And that makes sense. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with it, but at least that makes some sense. But here, we are exhausting state remedies. We're not asking the federal court to come in and tell the state court they did something wrong. We are doing exactly what the Supreme Court has suggested we do, is go to the state court first for relief. We are asking this court for relief. And that underlies Presser, it underlines Heck. The other piece that's important, and the court brings up Wilkinson, is we're not asking for immediate release. That is not what we're asking. Specifically, we want them to recalculate his target release date using the correct formula. That is all we're asking. Are we hoping that results in his early release? Absolutely. But that's not what we're asking for. We are asking that this court tell that we are able to, you know, go back to the district court and have the commissioner recalculate using the formula that it should have done, the formula that was used in 1975 when he was convicted.
So, Mr. Colbert, would you agree with me that you're challenging the length of his confinement?
We are challenging the calculation thereof. We're not necessarily, I mean, again, we're hoping, quite frankly, we are hoping that it be shorter, just like the people did in Wilkinson. We are hoping that it be done. But our argument is that they miscalculated. It is not, we're not saying, we didn't, as you can look in our complaint, we did not ask for his immediate release. We're not saying he needs to be out today. We are asking for a recalculation according to the correct formula that should have been applied.
Mr. Colbert, this is maybe an unfair question, but I'm wondering, this issue has to have occurred in other jurisdictions, in other states where there's a state 1983 remedy. Is there any case law out there that we could look to that has already considered this issue?
Yeah, you know, I can't say my research is exhaustive, but I thought the same thing, Your Honor. And I've cited a couple of cases that refer to it. But as far as I can tell, it's not. And this court has considered it a couple of times and quite frankly has ruled against this proposition, but they haven't really recognized or dug deep into the issue of what this is about. And I would suggest that if the court does look into this, I don't think there's any other conclusion that this is about federalism. And interesting, especially if you look at Heck, and Heck is particularly instructive because what they're concerned about is looking at the state court convictions. And that, you know, that's the idea of habeas. And again, I go refer back to the original discussion as the difference between in Minnesota, between a post-conviction and a habeas. And that this seems to be particularly well-suited to a civil 1983 action, because this has nothing, frankly, to do with his sentence. We're not challenging his conviction. And we're not challenging Talent to the 20-year sentence that he received. That would be appropriately, if we were to challenge that, via the post-conviction statute. But we're challenging exactly what we said in our complaint. We're challenging how the district court calculated his term of imprisonment. And that is...
But you also are challenging, you want the an order declaring the defendant or requiring the defendant to declare that plaintiff is eligible for conditional medical release. So that also is part of it. You want the commissioner to set a target date. I understand there is a target date set for 2025, I think, and a parole hearing in 2022. But you also want your client released on conditional medical release.
Yeah, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. We're not asking that he be released. We're asking that he be declared eligible for conditional medical release.
I'm trying to understand that fine distinction.
There are a lot of steps before you are released under conditional medical release. You have to make a determination as to, and the commissioner has set up these steps, in that once the determination is made that you're eligible, you are not released. I have had lots of clients who are eligible and not released for a variety of reasons, including the fact that they're a risk to the public or they don't have self-housing. So we're not asking for we're just asking that he be declared, as quite frankly, the commissioner declared, that he's eligible for conditional medical release. We're not saying he's being to be released. Those are steps that will follow. And again, I don't want to mislead the court. We are certainly hoping at the end of the day that he is released. We absolutely. But that's not what we're asking for.
I'd like to, well, your time has expired, but if I might ask the presiding judge for permission.
I will indulge you.
Thank you. So one thing that I'm a little hung up on your argument about federalism. You seem to be, your position is based upon federalism as between federal courts and state courts, as opposed to the idea of federalism that the federal legislature has created a federal statute. And whether it arises in federal court or state court, it seems to me that the issues of federalism would have just as much bearing on this issue as in the Presser Heck arena.
Well, Your Honor, if the 1983 statute had included some references to that, then that would be appropriate. But this is the Supreme Court and it's really important to recognize that this is this language precluding, requiring someone to proceed by habeas is not in the statute. It is not in the statute. It is something made up by the United States Supreme Court.
Right, but that's what I'm pressing on. Why isn't it the United States Supreme Court is saying, look, we've got a federal remedy, and we're not going to allow you to get around state remedies by using a federal remedy, regardless whether you bring up the federal remedy effort in federal court or state court. It seems as if the same federalism concerns would apply in a Section 1983 claim brought in state court as in federal court.
Because I think if you look at Presser, and it's the Presser, it couldn't be more clear, is that it's not about federalism in the writ large. It's about the federal courts. It talks about how most potential litigation involving state prisons should probably be handled by state bodies and state courts. The whole underlying premise is about federal court jurisdiction, and it's inescapable from reading Presser and Heck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so your time has expired, and you will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. We will now hear from the attorney for respondent. Let's get the clock ready for you. Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Corrine Wright-McLeod on behalf of the respondent, Paul Schnell, commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. The court should affirm for two main reasons. The first is that the Presser Heck line of cases bars Mr. Houston's ex post facto claim and his COVID conditional medical release claim. And the second is that his ex post facto claim is barred by collateral estoppel. I'll start with the Presser Heck issue. So the Presser court held that Section 1983 is the appropriate vehicle when challenging conditions of confinement, but it's not the appropriate vehicle for challenging duration or the fact of confinement. And it specifically said if an inmate or a prisoner his sole remedy, if he's seeking speedier or immediate release, is the writ of habeas corpus. The Heck v. Humphrey built on that. And it built on that principle, holding that when a Section 1983 action essentially necessarily implies a challenge to the length or duration, then before you can bring a Section 1983 claim, you have to have a prior invalidation of the incarceration in another proceeding. And that, Heck says that can be, the unlawful termination could be in multiple proceedings, but for today, we'll talk about writ of habeas corpus. And that's really what Heck, that's called the Heck's favorable termination rule. So it really does require that you go and you go to your state remedies first. And then if you prevail, then you're able to go ahead and bring a claim as a Section 1983 action. Now, Mr. Houston, the reason that Heck and Prizer relate to Mr. Houston's claims is that the ex post facto claim, undisputably, he's asking for an earlier parole eligibility date. So it goes right at the heart of the duration of his confinement. And the COVID conditional medical release claim is asking for early release from prison, something that he doesn't have a constitutional right to, but something that he's asking for, specifically immediate release. The ex post facto claim, he already brought a writ of habeas corpus to challenge his sentence, and he was unsuccessful. So Heck's favorable termination rule absolutely forecloses him from bringing that in a Section 1983 action. And yes.
Let me jump in just real quick. So were you able to find any case law outside of Minnesota applying this doctrine? I mean, certainly other states will allow for Section 1983 claims to be made in state court. There's no exclusive federal jurisdiction for that claim. Were you able to find any case law addressing the issues of federalism that Mr. Colbert's raising?
I was not, Your Honor. And I would also mention that I have audio that seems to be synchronous, but everybody is frozen, including my clock from my end. But to answer your question,
I'll just jump in just to assure you that we can still hear you and we can actually still see you. And you have okay. 11 minutes and like 35 seconds.
Okay, great. I'm frozen on 1241. So if I go over, please let me know. No, Your Honor, I also did some research to see how other states might handle this. And the conclusion that I come to really is that this isn't about the forum. This is about Section 1983 as an action. So there's absolutely no reason why Heck and Prizer wouldn't apply to a Section 1983 action in state court. State and federal courts have concurrent jurisdiction over a Section 1983 claim. So no, I haven't found any kind of case law suggesting that a Section 1983 claim in state court would suddenly not have Prizer or Heck or any of the other Wilkinson, that whole line of cases would somehow not apply to the federal action simply because it was brought in a state forum instead of a federal forum.
Thank you.
Still here.
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure if everything was frozen. Okay. So Prizer and Heck clearly apply to both of Mr. Houston's claims. Now, I know that Mr. Houston would like to distinguish his claims by using Wilkinson. And he's supporting, you know, he thinks that Wilkinson supports the idea that both the ex post facto and the conditional medical release claims aren't about speedier or immediate release. The thing about Wilkinson is that this was about folks who were challenging parole, not just parole eligibility, but the process for parole. And that was the core. Their relief was to get a new parole hearing. And what the Wilkinson court said was Prizer and Heck wouldn't apply in this situation because that's a little attenuated. There's too much room between asking for a new procedural, having a new procedural hearing versus relief where you're requesting either your parole eligibility date is moved up or release from prison. Those are, that's pretty clear relief. Whereas in Wilkinson, that really wasn't wrong.
Mr. Colbert is at least attempting to attenuate the relief that is being requested here. And, you know, I think he makes a point that he's not asking that he necessarily be immediately released. He is requesting that he be found potentially eligible for release, or that the eligibility requirements be examined. So in that respect, it does seem a little more like Wilkinson, right?
In some ways, I understand why he's making the argument, but this is a completely discretionary release program that the core of the relief is to be eligible for the program to be released. I mean, I think that distinction is harder to draw than the distinction in Wilkinson, where it really is you get a new parole hearing, and potentially, I mean, that is maybe an outcome, but that's not the point of the hearing. The point of the parole hearing isn't, let's see if you're eligible for release, for immediate release. The point of the COVID conditional medical release program is, let's see if you are eligible for immediate release. We're really trying to use this as a release valve to get folks out of prison because of the COVID pandemic. That's the point of conditional medical release, the COVID version of the conditional medical release. That was the point of the program. So certainly this idea that you're eligible for that program, but you're being successful doesn't mean immediate release, to me, is that distinction is just unconvincing. I do see a distinction between Wilkinson and the COVID conditional medical release.
So Ms. Wright-McLeod, just to take you in a different direction as to the sort of like first prong of the Presser, Prizer, Heck analysis, we have to consider whether such an action is precluded altogether based on those cases. And I'm wondering whether any of those cases focus on the 1983 statute as a basis for the conclusion that it's not available to state prisoners, or whether the focus is on the sort of comedy aspect.
Your Honor, I may not have understood your question. I apologize.
So yeah, sorry. It was long and rambling. And you now have 6 minutes and 30 seconds, just to be clear. I'm wondering
Thank
if any
you.
Of the cases...
I'm still at 1241.
I'm wondering if any of the United States Supreme Court cases do a statutory analysis of Section 1983 in considering the issue of whether that action is available to challenge a state court sentence or conviction?
Your Honor, not on point as far as whether or not the Section 1983 statute talks about the concurrent jurisdiction, whether or not someone could bring that statute in a different forum, if they could bring a Section 1983 claim in state court. I believe that's what you're asking, whether or not that the Supreme Court case law talks about that issue, about whether or not forum makes a difference.
Right. And whether the forum analysis is based on the 1983 statute or the principle of comedy, I think more specifically.
I do not believe those Supreme Court cases speak to the issues of federalism and comedy relative to which forum you can bring the Section 1983 statute in. There's no reference to what's a correct forum. And to me, that makes sense, because it seems that forum would be irrelevant. It's a federal action, and state and federal courts, there is case law that says that states and federal courts have concurrent jurisdiction over Section 1983 claims. So it seems to me that whether forum is important, it doesn't seem to be important relative to any of the analysis in those cases of Section 1983 as an action.
You asked that we make this a precedential opinion, and I'll ask both of you what you think the syllabus point would be.
Thank you. The syllabus point that the respondent would like, we respectfully request that the court affirm and then issue a precedential opinion holding that the Prisor-Heck doctrine, and specifically Heck's favorable termination rule, applies to Section 1983 actions brought in state court.
And I'll ask Mr. Colbert the same question when it's his turn.
May I respectfully request the time?
Absolutely. You've got 4 minutes on the dot.
Okay, great. If there are no more questions relating to Prisor and Heck, I'm happy to move on to the collateral estoppel issue.
I'm not seeing anybody jumping to unmute themselves. So go ahead.
Okay. It seems really clear that collateral estoppel bars the ex post facto claim. The identical claim was brought, and this court, you know, it was denied in district court. This court affirmed that denial, and the Minnesota Supreme Court did not pick up did not take the petition for further review.
Well, it is
the four element.
It is an equitable doctrine. So, should equity bear on whether we consider it? I mean, is that part of the equity in light of the fact that you have pro se on one hand, that sort of provides what you might expect in a pro se pleading, as opposed to a more thoroughly analyzed and considered argument by counsel representing in this appeal?
Your Honor, I don't think that the problem with this exception, that the court got it wrong, is that essentially all it does is, I mean, it completely neuters the doctrine in the sense that you're required to relitigate it to prove that the exception applies. I don't think that that's what the doctrine is meant to do, right? The doctrine is actually there to stop folks from relitigating claims over and over. And the sense, and to the extent that this is it was someone who was pro se and maybe didn't have a lawyer, case law in all kinds of areas tell us that, you know, if you're a pro se litigant, you're required, you know, there's some things that may be more favorable, right? We may look at a pleading more favorably for a pro se plaintiff, but simply using the fact that you're pro se to vitiate the doctrine and ask to go get a lawyer and relitigate it again, I mean, that can't, if that's an equitable consideration, it can't carry the day.
And you have about a minute and a half left.
I think the one thing I would note just from appellant's argument is this idea that there would need to be some kind of discovery relative to this ex post facto claim. And I would just like to point out that in the addendum on page 30, there is the probation matrix, that matrix that talks about parole, and it's discretionary, right? So parole is discretionary for sure. But then when you look at the matrix, there's nothing about anything here when you look at the law or the statute that suggests that Mr. Houston's sentence has been miscalculated. And so the idea that you need discovery, I mean, I think you can look at the statutes in the matrix and see that he falls right in line with where he should be. So to the extent that this should be a Section 1983 claim so that we can engage in discovery, I just think that's an unconvincing point. And I did want to bring that up since it wasn't in the briefing. I wanted to be able to respond to that if I could. So unless there are any other questions, certainly we already discussed the syllabus point, but I would like to ask the court to affirm and issue a precedential opinion on the Heck-Prisor doctrine.
Thank you, Ms. Wright-McLeod. And you finished with about 8 seconds, so nicely done, despite your lack of a clock. And now we'll go back to Mr. Colbert. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to start off by saying I think the rules of Zoom court is the respondents freezes, appellant wins, just as a general matter. I think that we have to start with that premise. What the commissioner doesn't address is regarding the ex post facto is they specifically admitted to relying on the current sentencing guidelines in determining his sentence. That
if we would brought that up because you argue that the commissioner is treating your client's sentence as a determinant sentence in imposing imprisonment. And I'm trying to understand the record basis for that.
So, you know, it gets into this really complicated idea of how good time was created at the time. And before then, and as the commissioner pointed out in their brief, that actually changed. But for a large part, from 1980, you received two-thirds of your sentence off immediately upon entering the prison. Right. So it was not. So the way it works under the determinant sentencing, let's say just for my math purposes, you get a 21-year sentence. You would do 14 years in prison and then 7 years on parole. Under the indeterminate sentence of a 21-year sentence, is you would get good time, would reduce the actual sentence, not the term of imprisonment. So your actual sentence at the year, you would expire, presuming you earned all your good time, at 14 years. And then short of 14 years, you'd be released sometime. And in the cases we cited, the court said, no one served the entire term of imprisonment. And that's what they're saying he has to do. That's where they set it out. And their calculation makes some sense when you look at the current guidelines. And I think this is a really important point. I can't emphasize enough. They said, we look at the current guidelines in determining a sentence. And the current guidelines have a much harsher sentence than the guidelines in effect when they first came into effect, but also much harsher than the parole matrix. The other point I want to say about the counsel talks about, well, there's the parole matrix, but they didn't follow the parole matrix. The requirement of the rules at that time is that they are supposed to comply a risk of failure assessment. And they simply didn't do that. If you look through, and again, we could, if there's discovery, we could find out how they calculated the sentence. And we could find out what happened what should have happened based on, and again, unfortunately, I have to admit, there aren't many people around like me who were around when these parole decisions were made. But it's really important to Mr. Houston's sentence. We should know what they did to calculate his sentence. And what the commissioner did here quite clearly is they kind of looked at what happens now. And that is, by definition, that violates ex post facto.
And what would your syllabus point be, Mr. Colbert?
Regarding which of the issues? Regarding the press hack, I would say the press hack doctrine is applicable in federal court and does not apply to state court proceedings brought in 1983 actions. And again, for one of the complications aspects of this, as I have to say, is it's not quite clear is whether there is a similar action under the Minnesota Constitution. I don't mean to throw a whole new issue at you, but that's what makes this particularly interesting, right? The idea of, sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Is there some language in Heck that supports the proposition that you're making? I mean, it seems to me that if the Heck had talked about comity or even jurisdiction, it didn't treat it as a jurisdictional issue. It said there simply is no cause of action under Section 1983 unless you've got unless these precursors have occurred. There's no cause of action. So, is there something that we could grab onto from the case itself, as opposed to just the suggestion that you're making that it was just a different form?
There is, Your Honor. It says one of the language in the introduction, the court talks about this case lies at the intersection of the two most fertile sources, and now I'm quoting, of federal court prisoner litigation. That's exactly what we're talking about. They're saying this is about federal court prisoner litigation. That's what they're concerned about in Heck, and that's appropriate concern for the federal court. It is not the concern of the state court. And Presser even more explicitly talks about the reason for this is we want to make sure, sorry, my time is up. So I will leave it at that.
All right. Thank you both for your very helpful and interesting arguments this morning. The case is now submitted.